Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. A morning where you have the president threatening to shut down social media platforms after Twitter fact-checked him yesterday on a tweet about mail-in ballots, or dissing a reporter who wore a mask and denigrating that as politically correct. We'll play that clip in a minute, which he did at a press conference yesterday. It may feel to some we are at peak, what my next guest calls Trumpocalypse, but according to our next guest, while an apocalypse may mark the end of something, this one signifies a possible new beginning. And coming from a neoconservative perspective, he is proposing a blueprint to restore America's democracy and dignity in his new book. Joining us now is David Frum, Atlantic staff writer, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and author of the new book, Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. Hi, David. Always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Let's start on the news. I want to play that clip of an exchange at President Trump's news conference yesterday where a reporter was wearing a mask and the president dissed wearing the mask as politically correct as the reporter tried to ask a question.
Your second question was? I couldn't hear you. Can you take it off? Because I cannot hear you.
I'll just speak louder, sir.
Oh, okay, good. You want to be politically correct. Go ahead.
No, sir. I just want to wear the mask.
Go ahead.
Any reaction to that, David?
Yeah, I've written a bit about this. The mask, Trump is not crazy to react to masks the way he does. The mask is a visible symbol of his failure. That Donald Trump promised again and again that this thing was going to go away on its own, that it was going to be contained, that it wasn't going to have an effect on his miraculous economy. And now he just gazes at ruin everywhere. 100,000 Americans confirmed dead. Certainly the number is higher than that. The worst economic shock since the Great Depression. No sign yet of the economy even touching bottom, much less a material recovery. The mask symbolizes all of that. That's why, you know, when Trump, pro-Trump people say, don't just say, I don't want to wear the mask myself, which is, look, the mask protects other people, so it's not really a libertarian act to refuse it. It's not like you're endangering yourself, you're endangering others. But they get angry when they see other people wearing the mask because they know the mask is a criticism and an accusation. Donald Trump understands that too.
It seems to me he's upping the ante on these things, even in recent days. So this is one example. I don't think there are many people who would argue that it's politically correct to wear a mask in the situation that the reporter was wearing it in. That is, you're in a group of people. Those reporters may be 6 feet from each other, but you have to go in, you have to go out, you're passing through and by and near a lot of people. That is, you know, classic situation now for almost everybody in America if they're in a, you know, clustered situation like that to wear a mask. That's different than Trump just not wearing one himself and saying, well, I get tested every day, so I know I'm negative today. I know I'm not putting anybody else at risk. It's different when he starts dissing somebody who's in a group and wearing a mask and calling it politically direct. Similarly, it's one thing to say we're going to have a reopening and we're going to do it safely with social distancing rules, et cetera, in the workplace or at a political convention, like I think he had been saying until this week. Now he's threatening to move the Republican convention out of North Carolina unless they allow full capacity, full assembly. So that implies in an enclosed arena that he doesn't even believe in reopening with social distancing and is trying to turn that into a political standard and a political weapon. So that's my perception. Do you see him actually upping the ante on what's real and what's fake just in the last few days?
He's trying to consolidate his blocking minority. This is actually one of the major themes of the new book, Trumpocalypse, that, you know, the United States is not the only country in the world with lively politics. I'm originally from Canada. Politics there are pretty lively, pretty intense. But in Canada, you can't make politics out of wearing a face mask during an epidemic caused by airborne infections. That people understand that, right wing, left wing, we all get wet in the rain. We all get cold in the snow. It's not right wing or left wing to wear mittens and our gloves in a snowstorm. It's not right wing or left wing to wear a mask during a pandemic spread by breath. But the Trump method is to carve out a blocking minority, to make everything a symbol of political disaffection. And the question that he leaves the country with as his presidency very probably comes to its close is, how do you restore normal government in a country where a third of the country, or thereabouts, has been so alienated from all of the institutions of the country, and where that third is a favored minority, that it's the political system again and again rewards that third with disproportionate power. It's not like a third, the third who live in Southern California, the system ignores them. These are the third who control the Electoral College, who control state governments, who control, who have disproportionate power in the House of Representatives. What do you do about that?
And you write in the first chapter of your book that whether Trump wins or loses re-election, America is facing some dangerous outcomes no matter what. What are you thinking of?
We are going to have a very rough economy in the post-Trump years. We're going to have a lot of very urgent healthcare problems. I think we've all been reminded of how things that look like something that is theoretical, like we've all known that a pandemic could be a problem, but we didn't process it until it exploded. And climate change will be the same way. So how do you deal with those issues in a country where the political system has stopped working? And Trump is both cause and symbol of that failure, and the issues go deeper than him personally, and that's the thing I've argued across now a sequence of two books. And he simply defeating him will not make the political system the way it was back in the 1970s or 1980s.
The title of the book, Trumpocalypse, is that just hyperbole?
Well, at the time we chose the title, it kind of was hyperbole. I felt a little bad about this, and there's some email traffic between me and the editor saying, I wonder, we're overstating things just a little bit. In the event, it may be understatement. We've got, 40 million Americans out of work. But an important thing about the word apocalypse, in everyday speech, we use it to mean just calamity, a zombie apocalypse, a murder hornet apocalypse. Hmm. But that's not actually what the word means. The word apocalypse comes from the Greek word for an unveiling, like taking off a garment, showing the underlying statue. An apocalypse is not a moment of destruction. An apocalypse is a moment of revelation. And it is a revelation specifically of the possibilities and dangers of a new world. That's what the writers of the Jewish and Christian apocalyptic revelation were dealing with. How will this world end and the next world begin? And I want to talk about that in a more secular context. I think we are at the end of a political era. We have a lot of choices to make. Just not to monologue this, but one more sentence about this. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that those of us in the pundit business get asked a lot is we're asked for predictions, or we're asked, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And I always resist this question, not just because of the risks of being wrong, although that's a factor. I resist it because predictions involve treating the future as a thing that exists, about which statements can be made. When, in fact, the future is something we make and we choose, and that the decision we have to make is to commit ourselves to making the kind of future that we want. And this book tries to offer a way to make that future.
I also did note the subtitle of the book. Obviously, people are going to seize on that one word title, Trumpocalypse, ha ha ha. And you just explained it in, an interesting, deeper way, what the word apocalypse has meant over time. But the subtitle is Restoring American Democracy, which suggests that not just this administration, but American democracy has been damaged. And I noticed that in the introduction to the book, you point out that the Pulitzer winning prize columnist, Kathleen Parker from the Washington Post, who leans more conservative, wrote a column on the eve of the 2016 election titled Calm Down, We'll Be Fine No Matter Who Wins, because our system of government will check the presidency. Yeah. Do you think that has not happened? I mean, he hasn't defied any court orders, which would really be a constitutional crisis. So how do you think democracy is holding up?
Well, I certainly didn't mean to single out Kathleen Parker for criticism, because that she just happened to write an especially vivid title expressing a point of view that was quite broadly shared.
Or some headline writer did.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. That's probably true. Many people have this view. And I definitely take the view that the Trump administration and the events since the advent of the Tea Party have done real damage to American democracy. And some of that is that they've exposed that rules you thought were there weren't there. I mean, probably most of us imagined there was some rule that the president couldn't operate a business while he was president. And he couldn't use the presidency to drive millions of dollars from taxpayers, from his political party, from outside groups, even from foreign entities to his. We thought after Watergate, you sort of tidied up all of that. But it turned out that was not true. The rules weren't really there. Or at any rate, they weren't binding. I mean, the famous Emoluments Clause of the Constitution isn't a law. It's just a constitutional direction. It's not self-enforcing. And we found again and again. I mean, you said the president hasn't defied court orders. That's true. But he has defied congressional subpoenas, which and has laid it down as a rule that a president does not need to honor a subpoena that is issued from a House of Congress controlled by the opposing party. And he's done that now for 2 years. To the point where I think the House still sometimes issues subpoenas, but they've accepted it's not really a tool of government. It's a symbolic tool, but it's not a tool of government. The president does not obey subpoenas, and the courts won't make them.
Have you reached that conclusion? Have the courts really said that they won't make him, or the Democrats haven't pushed it? They didn't push that question through the courts during impeachment because they wanted to impeach him at a at a rate that was doable, the courts would take months or years.
Well, a case involving congressional subpoena power is heading to the Supreme Court. It's usually known as Mazars after Trump's accounting firm. And the case takes, I believe, three or maybe four subpoenas from different committees of the House of Representatives, plus a subpoena from New York state prosecutors, and it consolidates them into one. And these committees have asked for different kinds of business documents, tax documents. The case was argued at the beginning of May, and the Supreme Court is supposed to render judgment by the end of June. And I will wager a free copy of Trumpocalypse to any listener who wants to take the other side of the wager that the Supreme Court will find a way not to answer that question before Election Day.
Not to answer that question. In other words, not take Trump's side, but not answer the question. How could they do that?
Here's what they can do. The idea is to buy him time so that the information that is sought by Congress, which might be very damaging, doesn't influence the election. What they do is the historic rule has been Congress subpoenas you. I mean, pretty much there are some outer limits. If you're a private they can't just say send a subpoena to you, Brian Lehrer, saying, I'd like to read your diary, please. So there's some for private people. There are some limits. But for people in government, if there is any information that Congress wants that is in any way pertinent to anything it might conceivably legislate on, even if it has no actual plan to legislate it, but if it might, then the subpoena is binding. And they're precedent after precedents going back to the 19th century. The Trump people laid out a whole new theory of the law of subpoena. They just made up that they created all these limits and balancing tests. So I think what the court is going to do is to say, we reject the Trump people's crazy theory, but we are going to say we are going to limit a little bit the precedents from the past, and then we're going to send the whole thing back to a lower court to be re-argued from the beginning. And when they do that, they bump the thing back so that no one will see this information before voting day. I don't know that that's what they're going to do, but as I said, I'll bet a free copy of the book that is what they do. And what that means, in effect, is the subpoena power becomes, for Trump, a dead letter in any reasonable time. And if you have to take a subpoena to the Supreme Court, and if the subpoena power, which used to be, Congress can see basically anything unless they're asking to see the diary of a private person, it's now going to become much more complicated and subject to court review, and we are going to be moving into an era when the courts are much more conservative and much more partisanly Republican than they used to be.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is David Frum, Atlantic Magazine staff writer, former George W. Bush presidential speechwriter, and author now of Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. And we can take phone calls. Anything you've always wanted to ask David Frum but didn't have him over to dinner, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280 for your calls for David Frum right now, or you can tweet a question at Brian Lehrer, but if you want to call in, 646-435-7280. When we come back from a short break, I want to come back to the subtitle of your book, Restoring American Democracy, which you just suggested won't be so easy. But it's the entire premise of the Biden campaign, pandemic aside, is restoring normalcy. So I'm going to ask you why you think it won't be so easy if Biden is elected when we continue with David Frum on WNYC. Lehrer on WNYC with David Frum from The Atlantic and author of the new book, Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. And I think you heard me tease the question I was going to ask before the break. Biden says he's running to restore normalcy. So let's say he gets elected and he appoints a normal attorney general and reinstates the inspectors general and starts to comply with congressional subpoenas when they're issued. Are we back to normal?
We're not quite back to normal. Those are all good starts. There is a question that a more partisan person, a Democrat, would have, which is, does normal mean that Democrats comply with subpoenas from Republican Congresses, but Republicans ignore subpoenas from Democratic Congresses? Is that the precedent that's being set? But the place I'd like to direct our attention is to the state-level politics. And that is really where American democracy has most come unstuck since 2010. Of course, 2010 was a very tough economically. And so the party of the president, President Obama's party, took losses. And Republicans in 2010, 12, 14 acquired a dominance at the state level not seen for Republicans since the 1920s. I don't think for either party seen since the 1920s. And of course, 2010 was a census year. So these new overwhelmingly Republican state governments were able to use the census of 2010 to redistrict in pretty radical ways at the state level in 2011. And then in 2013, the Supreme Court struck down important sections of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And that court decision was not as crazy as some people will think. They had some good arguments. We can get back to that later. But they didn't say that it was unconstitutional. They said certain parts of it were irrational and needed to be rewritten. But that never happened. And so the result, and then, of course, in 2019, the Supreme Court said partisan gerrymandering is okay. And in the United States, of course, partisan gerrymandering means racial gerrymandering because the parties have such strong racial identities. So there's a green light to state and local governments to do some pretty extraordinary things, which is why in a state like Wisconsin, the Republicans have almost two-thirds of the seats in the two houses of the Wisconsin legislature, even though they won fewer votes than Democrats in 2018, 45%. And that is replicated across a range of states. And that is a problem that is not going to go away. Remember, it is state governments that draw not only state boundaries, but also the boundaries of the federal Congress, too.
Eric in Middletown, you're on WNYC with David Frum. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Brian, you're the best part of my Groundhog Day every day. Thanks so much.
It is the same day after day if you're on lockdown, right? Okay, go ahead.
It's the best part, without a doubt. Anyway, David, I had a question. So I wanted to get your take on, you know, you mentioned constitutional crises and that nothing had really come up yet. Trump has kind of planted the seeds that, you know, whatever happens in the fall, he's going to claim fraud if he loses, even by a lot, in terms of like voter fraud and all that. He's kind of seeding the argument already. There are some folks who don't think he's going to leave, period. And just given what the Congress has done, the Republicans, they essentially were complicit with impeachment and, you know, went along with a lot of things that I don't think 3 or 4 years ago most Americans, or at least I would have thought, they would have. And so we continue to see this sort of breaking of norms. Do you think he'll leave? And if he doesn't, what are the actual triggers, the self-enforcing mechanisms that exist to force and compel him to leave?
That's an interesting question. And this is going to take us all back to knowledge we all had during the recount of 2000 and have probably purged from many of our memories. So after the people vote, there are a series of, as you said, important steps. Probably the most important of the steps is that in mid-December, the Electoral College meets and certifies a winner. If that happens, I think at that point, Trump has no recourse. Because once the Electoral College has certified a winner, the inauguration date is in the Constitution. So whether Trump actually, like, if Trump were to say, oh, that's it, I'm not leaving the White House, at midday on January 20th of 2021, he stops being president. So now we have a squatting problem. But there's no question of legal authority that the nuclear codes disappear. The briefings stop. He's not president anymore. So at that point, we have a tenant removal problem, but we don't have a legal problem. The moment of danger is that moment from the point of view the caller alludes to, is the moment from the day of the vote until the day of the meeting of the Electoral College, and that could get pretty tense. Both. Does Trump impede the count? Does he try to extend the kind of situation we saw in 2000? That was a forewarning of what was to come. And the second thing is, if he does become convinced it's hopeless, how does he use the period of the transition? Does he issue a lot of pardons to criminal associates? Does he issue pardons to his relatives? Does he pardon himself? We've never litigated the question of whether a president has that power. It never came up. Does he try to pardon himself? Does he try to negotiate a deal with Vice President Pence where he steps aside at the last minute, Pence becomes president, and Pence pardons him? And that would almost certainly be legal, even if it's dubious in all kinds of other ways. So we may have a very bumpy period from the election to the transition. And last question is, does Trump then sabotage the economic recovery? Because the president will have a lot of ability to do that as well.
Hmm. But what about delegitimizing and casting doubt on the election process, like he's tried to do with all this talk of mail-in ballots being seed ground for a widespread fraud?
This is not a one-time thing. This is a problem that has been building for a long time, and that's these kind of bigger-than-Trump problems are the things that preoccupy me in Trumpocalypse. I think people, probably some of the people listen to you may say, oh, the Republicans are always doing this. It's not true exactly. President Bush signed a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The Voting Rights Act expires at intervals. And I'm now going to forget. I think it was 2005 he signed it. The transitions have normally gone reasonably well. The Bush-Obama transition in 2008-2009 in particular is one for the history books. In the middle of these terrible circumstances of the economic collapse, it was handled remarkably. Obama people were invited to attend economic briefings, not to talk because they're not the government yet, but they're there at the table from election day to inauguration day. It was a very, very smooth handover, so much so that Obama in 2012, when it was unsure whether he was going to be reelected, he directed his administration to do for Romney, if need be, what George Bush had done for him. These things can work. But so I think we are into a new era of more extreme partisan competition based on the fact that the Republican Party has shrunk, where it has become pessimistic about its ability to win in Democratic competition.
Do you think that on the question of mail-in ballots and what the Trump people are trying to lean on here, which is what they call ballot harvesting or ballot collection, which takes place under different circumstances, under different legal standards in different states. And I gather there's a point in the HEROES Act, the current bill that the House has passed and the Senate is just now considering, expands the legality of ballot collection, which is the point that the Republicans argue is the potential for fraud. If other people are collecting your ballots and delivering them en masse, they can pressure you into voting one way before you seal the envelope. They can, play all these tricks. Do you think the Democrats have a responsibility now to get out there and be very specific about what the standards for mail-in ballots, including ballot collection to the extent that it would go on, would be? Or should they just ignore Trump and say that's a conspiracy theory?
No, look, this is obvious. They're bad faith arguments, but that doesn't mean they're untrue arguments. And the as you so well say, ballot harvesting is an issue. There was a case in 2018 of ballot harvesting fraud in North Carolina for a Republican. So that's a potential problem. And you know, you can well imagine that.
And it was bad enough that that election got thrown out. A Republican congressman who won had the election overturned because somebody on his behalf was committing absentee ballot fraud.
Right. And you can imagine there are other circumstances where there could be some hazards, nursing homes, for example, or if any state decides to let prisoners vote, voting in prison. There are real issues here. Look, the problems I'm talking about in Trumpocalypse are not always easy problems, but they are problems that people of goodwill and good faith with differing and conflicting interests can negotiate. I mean, historically, that's the way at our best we've done things. Not that mm-hmm. it's easy, mm-hmm. but there's just enough goodwill, enough belief in the system. And, you know, some people mm-hmm. want to make it easier to vote in the hills and others want to make it easier to vote in the dales. And they work it out. What we're having now is more where Republicans in the Trump era are saying out loud something that has not been said out loud since the civil rights era of the 60s, which is maybe not all Americans should be voting. People have thought that. They don't say it, or they haven't said it from the 60s until today, and they're saying it again.
We have 1 minute left in the segment. I'm going to take a caller who's going to ask you a question that I think you can answer in two words. Ken in Park Slope, you're on WNYC with David Frum.
Yes, gentlemen. I was wondering if Mr. Frum had any thoughts on Joe Biden's running mate. A possible running mate.
You're asking who should he? Thank you. He's asking you, who do you think Biden should pick?
I may need six words, not two. I don't get involved in internal Democrats. I'm a registered Republican. It's not my thing. What I would just say is, given that Biden is the oldest man ever to seek the presidency, given that we're in a pandemic, I hope he picks somebody who's able to do every aspect of the job, especially foreign policy, on day one. This is no time to introduce somebody new to the federal government. So people mention people who are members of the House. I would strongly oppose that. There's someone like Susan Rice has a problem of never having been elected to anything, which is an issue. But at least I would want to go in the direction of, if anything happens to him, including just incapacitation fraud, suppose he gets the disease and is sick for 3 weeks, there is someone who can handle the foreign affairs of the United States instantly.
David Frum, Atlantic staff writer, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, author of the new book, Trumpocalypse, Restoring American Democracy. And if you want to see more of David, can they see you at this? I see you're doing a virtual bookstore event from the Washington or with the Washington, D.C. bookstore, Politics and Prose, tonight at 7:00. Is that on Zoom? Can people see you in that?
It is absolutely. It is visual, and we'll try to make it visually interesting too.
All right, that's a Politics and Prose event with David Frum tonight. Thanks, David. We really appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here. Bye bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come.